Donalena Kitchen talks about food. Donalena Kitchen talks recipes. Donalena Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalena Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here around our kitchen table once a week to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. And we are here at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in downtown Ames, Iowa, the center of Iowa, the center of the country, the center of it all. Well, we talk about cooking here, Donna,
and eating. That's the easy part.
Just to be human, you have to kind of learn how to feed yourself. Now, this is a huge gamut. Some of us learned how to run a can opener pretty early in life, and some of us rely awfully much on Uber and driving up to takeout places, and there's a lot of stuff
that is not cooking. That could be eating, but that is
okay,
not cooking.
But then there's the microwave. You push the button on the microwave, eh?
Not at my house.
I know, but we like to actually dive in and cook. I remember you learn to cook when you get hungry. I went away to college and decided, well, I'm going to live off campus. And boy, you know, you kind of look at the kitchen and learn all kinds of things and call home. And so by now, I've learned a lot, especially from you, Donna.
So things
are good. So different people learn to cook different ways. And lots of us are still learning. And at the other end of the spectrum from just like calling Uber or pushing the microwave, there are those who really love the whole process. And we're going to talk to a young man today who grew up in Ames, Iowa, believe it or not, and decided to expand his horizons and go to culinary school. We're going to learn about that experience today. And it wasn't just culinary school down the road. Now, he went to is currently in Barcelona, Spain. Joining us at the kitchen table today is Jacob Travisset.
Welcome, Jacob.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, so Jacob, as Lana said, is an Ames boy. He's a family friend. I watched him grow up, and he started being interested in food and more interested in food and making funny little things in the kitchen. And we went, and then in high school, we kind of thought, you know, maybe Jacob would like a job in a professional kitchen. So we kind of lined him up at Stomping Grounds because I think Brett DeBleek, who is the chef there, is probably one of the most well-trained professional chefs in the country.
Absolutely, in town, for sure. Yeah.
I mean, he's really studied and worked in a lot of different places. And, you know, even though he's low-key, he is quite skilled. And I thought, that is a good place for Jacob to be introduced to a professional kitchen. And it was.
And it was really good. It was definitely a really good introduction. I mean, I started washing dishes. I remember the...
Always the place you need to start.
Always the place you start.
Yep.
I remember the interview. I was talking with the owner, and he was saying, like, we're going to start in the kitchen. You'll work your way. And I was like, that's perfect. That's all I need. Like, and I started working 3 days a week. So 2 days I'd do dishes. And then on Saturdays, I'd help in the kitchen a little bit with prep. In the mornings, and at one point after a couple months, they told me, we're going to actually train you to be on the line cook, and that's when I started actually working in the kitchen for the first time.
Yeah, so you started in the very traditional way. We were really proud. You took to it like a duck takes to water, as they say. So for a while, I was calling him our baby chef, but now you can't call him that anymore. So Jacob's parents are from Catalonia.
Yeah.
So he's fluent in Spanish, and I guess that...
And Catalan as well.
Yeah, that influenced your decision on where to go to school.
Oh, absolutely.
So, yeah, tell us about the culinary school in Barcelona, Spain, that you are currently
So I think it's good to start, like, how exactly I found it. So I knew I wanted to leave the U.S. I definitely thought that I could definitely expand a lot more in my learning in terms of leaving Ames, Iowa, and Iowa in general, especially since I had this such a big connection to Barcelona. I spoke the
language.
Which
is a very hot, high cultural scene for food and for the past 15 or 20 years. So.
And especially after the influences of really these big restaurants like El Bulli and Disfrutadis, like, it's really become a culinary powerhouse in a way.
Right, right. It's more important than going to Paris or London or something like that. Yeah, it's a big deal.
And I started looking for places in Barcelona. My mom had a few friends. My dad had a few friends who they talked to. Like I said, like, which one is good? Like, we're trying to look for. And all of them said, every single one kind of just, like, disagreed on who was second, third, or fourth. But all of them agreed, like, this one was the best, which is the Hoffman Culinary School, the one I'm currently at.
Okay. Hoffman does not sound like a Spanish name.
I'm pretty sure. originally the chef who opened it, her name was May Hoffman. Mm-hmm. She was really Catalan, but I'm guessing her family had some German or around their origins.
Maybe they started when French influences were dominant
The restaurant originally started, so around, I actually was talking about this the other day with the chefs, around the 1990s, around there.
Oh, okay.
Around there. So that's when the restaurant first started.
The cooking school and the restaurant, or just...
Yes. So the cooking school was open for like 2 years before they installed the restaurant in.
Okay. So let's explain to the audience. When you go to the school, you learn by cooking in a restaurant.
Yes.
And it is a Michelin-starred restaurant as well.
I would say it's almost around 50-50. I would say even more time in the restaurant than actually doing classes and stuff like that, which is pretty abnormal for a culinary school in general.
Well, did they start you washing the dishes then?
No. The way it's structured is, so you start in September-ish, and then we would go from that September to December, we would work inside the school, inside of a kitchen, and they would basically teach us techniques. It teaches you the basic. They start, first class is like how to use a knife, like really, really basic stuff. And then once in January,
your use of knives when you came home that first Christmas extended to how to sharpen them, did all the students get into knives like you did?
No. That's definitely more of my thing.
I took all my knives over for Jacob to sharpen because he did such an incredible job.
I had this idea. They didn't really teach us actually anything about sharpening knives. It was mostly, they told us how to use it, and they gave us this like small set of knives, which are pretty decent to start out with. And I really wanted to get good at sharpening knives. It was something I found pretty therapeutic. And I got my own whetstone and all that stuff and learned mostly on my own, actually.
And did you say there's a really good knife store in Barcelona? Must have picked up some tricks there.
So the one we went to that I got I have a really good knife store now that's like my knife store that I always go to, and it's right by my house.
On a first name basis, you are. Yeah. Oh, here comes Jacob. Oh, boy. Let's get the fancy stuff.
They offered me a job as a knife sharpener. But that one wasn't open, actually, when I first started.
Oh.
It was pretty recent that this one opened. The other one is somewhat out of Barcelona, and this is where that's where I bought the whetstones and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And my first knife, my Toshiro black one.
Yeah, Jacob is heavily into the Japanese knives.
They're the best.
I mean, for years it was the German knives, and that's what I started with and what I mostly own. But I have gotten a few Japanese knives over the years just because everybody was raving about it. I thought, I got to see what these are. So,
yeah, speak a little bit about why knives are important in a kitchen.
God.
I know you're going, oh my God.
I have said this on the show before. Everybody should own one knife, one basic cutting knife that costs at least $50 to get, to get beginning quality. Once you have a good knife, first of all, you will have it for years if you take good care of it. And, especially if you learn to sharpen it yourself, because sharpening and finding, like in LA, there were places that would go around to the restaurants professionally and sharpen all the knives. So I never had problems keeping my knives sharp. Here, this is why I was so thrilled when Jacob sharpened my knives. I was like, oh, I haven't had a knife like this for 20 years. So tell us about the latest in knife.
I mean, I actually would say argue we need two knives. Everybody should have two knives. So obviously the big chef knife that everybody should have, like a nice chef knife. And I'd even say like spend some good money on one. I think a lot of times I've heard a lot of people say like they kind of want to spend a good amount of money talking about like over $100
absolutely
on one of these nice knives. And it's like a commitment to like try
to scare people.
Learn how to cook. Yeah.
But you know, once you get a decent knife, then you want a really better knife anyway. Yeah. So
it's like a small
and what
investment.
Do you think the 6-inch chef knife is if people are only going to have one good knife?
How much is it?
The blade.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So 6 inches are kind of this in between, right? So my knife is 9 inches, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's 20 centimeters. So
well, there. I have multiple sizes. Obviously. Yeah. Like you don't whack into a watermelon or a big squash with a 6-inch knife very easily. But
yeah. Yeah. And for a second knife, I would say getting a nice, like, small little paring knife.
Those are not that expensive.
Yeah, and
even
those you can buy cheap and they're fine.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I have my big one, and then I have this kind of in-between petty, which is I usually use it for, like, cleaning lots of birds and also sometimes fish and...
He means chickens.
Yeah.
Mostly, yeah. Right.
Well,
that's the only birds we eat here,
that is
Jacob,
true.
You know, I mean.
I've never found a squabber here.
No.
And then I have a tiny little paring knife for turning.
Well, so tell us what you think about the difference between the Japanese knives and the European knives.
So it's a matter of the steel. Typically, European steels in general are a lot softer. So that kind of means that they're a lot more forgiving in a way. They're not as delicate. A lot of Japanese knives, especially those really, really high quality ones, these ones that are really packed with carbon and such, are really delicate to the point where if you hit them a little bit wrong, they will snap in half.
Right. Well, we're not recommending those for the unprofessionals. And plus, if they're carbon steel, you really have to keep them.
You have
for
to be
rusting.
Really careful with them. Some of my knives, like I have this one carbon steel, and I don't even take it to the restaurant because it's really delicate, and it will oxidize on you.
It's a Japanese one.
Yeah, it'll oxidize on you in, like, if you leave it out with some kind of like liquid on it, it'll oxidize in a minute. Like you can see it in real time as it oxidizes.
Oh, right, so you gotta wipe it.
Yeah.
Keep it.
It's
really,
kind of like
really
a trophy
dry.
Knife, almost at that point.
Yeah. Well, it's a boy toy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What the stuff that you are learning to cut up and cook? You mentioned poultry and fish. Talk about some of the ingredients that you even get that you start. Actually, this school sounds amazing.
Right after knife skills, what do they teach you?
Yeah. So once we finish these like kind of entry classes, where it's a lot of techniques. Like they basically would have this, like they would show us a dish and then they would. We were supposed to replicate it the next day. So it was kind of like almost like a, like the way it literally worked is like so one day you'd come in the mornings and the chef would cook the dish basically.
Oh, so you at least watched him
make
it.
Yeah. Right. So he'd cook it from zero and then, but he wouldn't give you a recipe. He wouldn't give you anything. And the idea is that you took notes. And then the day after you would come in a little bit later in the afternoon. And you would cook the dish. You would have all the ingredients in front of you and you just had to execute the technique, basically. And a lot of times the recipes in particular were chosen to implicate a certain technique.
Yeah.
One that was like, this one, you have to poach this fish and you're trying to make it perfect, get the poaching time perfect. But there's a huge part of it where it's like, it's more about learning the technique and what it is rather than perfecting it. Because then after, once we start in January, we start switching between back and forth between the restaurant and our classes.
Right, because experience is the best teacher.
Exactly.
How many students are in a class with you?
So in my year, there's around 30 classmates. I have around 30 classmates. And then that's split into two. So for instance, back in January, we do like 2 weeks at the restaurant and then 2 weeks in theory classes, and these two classes would switch off. So while one class is in theory, the other class is in the restaurant and so forth. And we go switching back and forth.
Is, so do you learn to cook solo or do you learn to cook in a bunch? I mean, it seems both would have its advantages and disadvantages.
Do you mean like, as in like a teamwork kind of thing?
Or yeah,
more
yeah,
like, yeah.
So, when you learn and when you prepare dishes, is there a team or are you totally responsible?
So it's kind of interesting because the way when we come into the restaurant, it's, we're basically assigned the dish. So like at the beginning, before the 2 weeks, like on the Friday before the 2 weeks start, before that Monday that you'd come in, you'd get basically like this list and it would say like, this person is in charge of this dish and like the dish and then the name.
Okay,
and
the idea what is was the first dish you had to cook in the restaurant?
The first dish I had to create was these tortellos. So basically this ravioli, it was like a kind of like a carbonara type thing. And we'd fill it with, make these big raviolis with mascarpone and then an egg yolk inside.
Oh, that's the one you made the first time you came home at Christmas. Yes.
And then with guanciale and a bunch of other
things. Well, and the thing is, with the egg yolk inside, we have to tell everybody that the egg yolk had to be soft when the ravioli was punctured. We're not talking about a hard-boiled egg yolk in a ravioli. It was very delicate. It was delicious. I had so much fun watching. I got to be a sous chef while he was doing it, because sometimes more hands are helpful.
Exactly.
So that was your first...
So that was the first dish that I made in the restaurant.
Okay, so by then they've taught you the saucing part to make the filling, the pasta part, and the assemblage, and then the plating.
And now in the restaurant, like when you work in the restaurant, we weren't working with like no recipes. Like we would get also a list of all the recipes, and this, you end up with this
follow
huge,
the plan, yeah.
Yeah, this huge folder of like, you're supposed to memorize them and write them down. And obviously the first weeks are awful because you barely know where anything is and you're just like, it seems like so much work, and obviously as you get better you get faster and it feels like less work each day. But
well this is the old thing in restaurants, and probably they work you so hard that the people that are not cut out for it just leave, right?
Yeah.
So did the classes dwindle in size?
Not a lot, but there definitely is, for instance, like a huge, like there have been one or two people who have like left the course, basically. But that's mostly because they've kind of found out it's like, it's not really their thing.
Right. And, it looks good on television, but
I would say in general, the biggest thing that happens over time is there's a huge difference between the people who start to really apply themselves. And the other people kind of just come there and don't really care.
For fun?
Yeah, almost.
Because their parents want them to do something.
And there comes this, like, it starts out like everybody's like the same, right? Like, there's no really difference between everybody. And then after like half a year, you can clearly tell of like who's really like there to learn.
Oh, I have a question. Your school that you're studying at and the restaurant that you're working at is in Barcelona, Spain, and I hear about wonder. It's such a popular, wonderful cultural mecca that it's almost too many people are descending on the place. So it must be a wonderful place to just be in a creative business. Mm-hmm. Who does the shopping for a restaurant like you do? Are you involved in ingredients from the get-go, or are things on the table?
But no, that's probably what they have to teach you.
So
that's half the job.
Yeah,
sourcing.
Well, yeah, well, at this point we. In terms of ingredients, mm-hmm. at the restaurant, it was always like, because at the end of the day, the chefs are watching you and all that stuff, but you're in charge of, you know, procreating this dish and making it so it gets to the client.
Ha.
And so we would have to ask, like, you'd like given a little list to the chef and be like, I need these ingredients, and they'd order them. So we would have people would come in and they deliver this from what would be the distributors that are around Barcelona, particular usually in Mercabarna, which is this huge commercial store, these types of places where you can't buy from if you don't have a restaurant.
For commercial businesses only.
Exactly.
But they took you to the fish market.
Exactly. So we
to the meat market.
This year is when we usually start doing kind of our like field trips, kind of.
Right, because you have to understand what is the difference between a 3-year-old fish and a freshly caught fish. They look different. They feel different. They smell different.
That part in particular mostly comes from experience in the restaurant. Mm-hmm. Not even especially from the markets. You kind of get to know the fish just by you see them enough times. You kind of get an idea. Mm-hmm. I'd say the most thing you kind of learn from going to Mercabarna, which is we had these the Mercabarna divided in 2 days because it's so huge. And we went to Carnia, which is a meat distributor of Spain, in which they do the whole, basically each day they come in like 100 like cows and beef that were just butchered like that morning.
Okay, so they're processors. They break they break the carcasses so down, the meat.
They do the whole process of the rigor mortis and then they break them down and they package them and there's just
so breaking them down means cutting them into steaks and what needs to be ground and what needs to be this, that, and the other. That's called breaking down the carcass.
And then they work.
Did they teach you how to break down carcasses or on a pig or something? Or just chickens and
fish?
We're
taught the cuts of meat, but the thing is, it's like really rare that any chef is really going to, it's like pretty rare that any chef is going to have to like know how to do this and to break down a whole cow or break down a whole pig. So
don't worry. I bet in the next 5 years you're going to want to learn that. It's fun.
No, and it's at some point it kind of. I think it's more of a thing.
It's a challenge.
It kind of comes in, like somebody comes on along down the line and they show you to do it.
Well, I was talking about last night two of these friends of mine about 15 years ago from very high end restaurants, one in Portland and one in Chicago, came to ISU for a week for what they called sausage boot camp, where they were learning at ISU how to make sausage, because of course in their restaurant they wanted to go back and make their own sausages seasoned the way they wanted to season them. And that, so I mean, okay, that is the wonderful thing about cooking, especially about cooking professionally. You are always learning. There's always some new food or ingredient or cuisine to study and traveling. It's just fun. It's never ending.
It's definitely one of the things I really love about cooking is like this kind of thing of like you start to learn stuff and you learn, and the more you learn
enough to know what you're looking at learn more. Yeah.
And then the more you learn, the more you suddenly can expand, like suddenly understand more, and that understanding more leads to more questions. And then you go to some random place and you try something and you're like, what is that? I've never tried that. That's incredible.
There's a world
comes
full
in
of
this
ingredients.
Whole rabbit hole of different
flavors, ingredients,
flavors.
And techniques too.
Exactly.
Endless techniques.
Yeah, techniques really are endless. It's really
fantastic.
Crazy.
So the people that run the restaurant are also the teachers?
Yeah.
Oh.
So there's a group of teachers that work solely in the actual school part. And then separated from that is the chefs who work in the restaurant.
Huh.
There's about four chefs in the restaurant. So there's two for the morning shift and two for the night shift.
Huh.
And how many students then are on each shift in the restaurant?
So then 15-15 it'd be around-ish.
Oh, so the whole cohort goes in and has two chefs overseeing them to like bring out the dinner.
Exactly, yeah.
So in your cohort, you must already know who are the let's call them the weak links. So, and this is going to be true in any kitchen you work in. Some people are more skilled than other people, and you have to work around with whatever is there, you know?
It's actually interesting because even talking to, for instance, our academic director and stuff like that, like, this is something they really take into account, how usually there's this kind of balance between the group that they get, and it's pretty standardized between all the years. It's a pattern that usually shows up in that. There's, like, out of the 15, you'll say you'll have, like, four that are like actually really strong and like know what they're doing. You'd have like a couple five, six that are like decent, like they get their job done, but they don't really do more. And then you'd have your three that usually pull down the group a little bit.
That's like life in general. Yes, we're talking to Jacob Travisette about his experience in a in a Michelin...
starred culinary school in Barcelona.
Oh, isn't that... We'll be back after this short station break. You're listening to KHOI, and this is Donald on the Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donald on the Kitchen. We're talking about learning to cook, and we talk about food and recipes and cooking here on the Donald on the Kitchen. Now, I know sometimes it's a lot of hard work, but somebody's got to do it. I've been tasting ice cream this summer, and I finally got around to visiting the ISU Creamery, which is located, it is a student-run ice cream place, located on the second floor of the Food Sciences Building. It's a little hard to find, but there's always a graduate student or somebody standing around, and they will help you. You find your way in the middle of the building there, and they have wonderful ice cream. And I was talking to Jacob earlier about they had a really good. It's like their waffle cone. It's like somebody made it. It's more like a cookie. It was just absolutely delicious besides the ice cream being good. So try that. It's on the ISU campus.
Well, this is another form of culinary training. So in the ISU department, what's it called? Life sciences or something? I don't know.
Food science?
What's it called? Food science?
I think it's life sciences.
I don't know. But the point of that education is to teach people to formulate products that large food manufacturers mm-hmm. can replicate, basically. Yep. Now, that is nothing like the training that Jacob is having.
Yeah,
with the kind of school Jacob's going to, almost the point of it is making it so nobody else can do it. It's it's a little esoteric. But that's from one extreme to the other.
And we all survive. We all eat food and ice cream. Anyway, that was good ice cream. I've enjoyed ice cream.
Now, that ice cream will have things in it that the ice cream that Jacob makes or what I make at home, we won't use. They'll be using stabilizers and gums and things, because that ice cream is made to be frozen commercially and sit in freezers for months, perhaps years, who knows? But yeah,
most importantly, maintain that texture that is so crucial to having
the texture and the flavor, so it doesn't degrade. And cost. Yeah. Low cost is important when you're creating a product like that.
I can tell you now that these stabilizers and stuff are not cheap.
Yeah.
Some of those stabilizers can be really expensive. You can get like 500 grams of them, and they can be like $40 around there, 40 euros. And to be fair, you're using around like 8 grams per or 6 grams per liter-ish. But
well, see, I'm thinking they should be spending more on the vanilla or the flavorings, because that's where I like to spend my money. Although I have to say, we did this one thing this summer, and Jacob had some, and Lana did too. So the Perfect Scoop, which is by, what's his name?
Leibowitz.
Which one?
I don't know.
Anyway, he's an American who worked at Chez Panisse, and then David Leibowitz, and lives in Paris. But he wrote a book specifically of recipes for homestyle ice cream makers, which is what I have. I have a very good one, but it's still, small capacity with its own freezer. So he was using basically sour cream and heavy cream, and then the fruit puree. His was mm-hmm. peach. Mine was the plum rose geranium. And I did put a little bit of vodka in, because having a tiny bit of alcohol keeps it from freezing so hard. But the sour cream, and I didn't use one with gums and stuff. I used a really good one, the Kelowna. Mm-hmm. I thought the texture was just wonderful. For a homemade ice cream, it really worked.
Typically, these milk-based or kind of like lactose-based ice creams are somewhat easier to make, at least homemade-wise, because they milk and sour cream and all this stuff, or egg yolk, which is usually the
traditional
typical...
ones have are custards with egg yolks and all of that. But this one was so like, throw in the sour cream, throw in the cream, just, you know, mix it up with a whisk and put it in the ice cream maker. And it was like, whoa.
Yeah. And those emulsifiers really help.
Yeah.
Help it stabilize and keep it stable. And which a sorbet usually wouldn't have those egg yolk and that milk and all
no,
that cream.
But with this sorbet, you can't, you know, a little alcohol will keep it from getting frozen like an ice cube kind of thing. But so you, what's this ice cream like? I remember when Jacob first went to Spain, he hadn't started school yet, but he called me up and he wanted to make ice cream for his cousin. And I said, well, Jacob, you need a machine, you know, because it's got to go around and get cold at the same time and stuff like that.
I'll start somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. So, so now he knows how to make his own ice cream. So,
yeah.
Yeah. Talk about your ice cream experience in Barcelona.
So, in particular, it's actually really fun. Like the school itself, apart from being a really good culinary school, it's really well known for their pastries, actually. And their pastry
store. Right, they have a whole separate pastry program, right?
The whole separate pastry program. And what's even more well known than the restaurant, which is still really pretty well known, is the pastry shop, which is where they sell like these little cakes and these little fancy
chocolates.
Little things. And chocolates and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And with that comes ice cream, of course. But the ice creams that we do is typically a lot different than, for instance, what I've seen and tried. Donna's types of ice creams, in which we use these special sugars, we use emulsifiers, we use little fun, fancy little powders and a billion different types of sugars to create these like basically perfect formulas, these ice creams, and so that those not only the flavors are strong, but they keep that texture that we want.
Yeah, talk about, you said the restaurant has a policy of keeping the ice cream fresh because if you freeze it, then it's a little different.
Basically, how ice cream works is this is kind of perfect formula in between how the sugars will bring down the freezing temperature and not turn it into a block of ice, and how the emulsify and the crystals and everything, and they create this kind of creamy texture.
What kind of things are you using for emulsifiers?
We have these little funny little fancy little powders.
powders. Okay.
Basically
carrageenan.
They're basically emulsifiers. So
like
literally
lecithin kind of things?
Kind of. It's a mix of different things. But for instance, they're literally called like we have these two little little containers that they come in by the company of Sosa, which is a company in Spain, and they produce a lot of these different types of powders. That are usually emulsifiers or create gels and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And one of them is called Pro Sorbet, and one of the other ones called Pro Creme. And you can imagine what they're for.
Mm-hmm,
And they're just emulsifiers. So it's about it, and they stabilize the ice cream. If you're like, and it comes to the point where if you make an ice cream and it still feels like a little bit unstable, next time you make it, you chuck in a little bit more emulsifier, and that's it. There's nothing more.
Sounds like making jelly.
So tell me about the flavors. What are you using for flavors?
So because of the fact that it's a restaurant and we actually integrate a lot of ice creams into the actual savory part as well. So apart from the whole pastry side, which is the same thing, but a little bit more standard, I guess, in a way. We make ice creams. I remember we did this one with rosemary. That was really, really nice.
So that was a savory one.
Actually, no, it was pretty sweet. But it came to the point, these ice creams are so strong in flavor that they're a little sweet, but they're not that sweet. They're a lot less sweet than typical ice cream shop ice creams.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, the one thing that one does learn, a cold product such as ice cream, the sensation of sweetness is somewhat diminished. Mm-hmm. So when you're making like a custard or a base or ice cream, you tend to make it a little bit sweeter than you want it to taste when it's frozen.
Yeah.
But so what kind of dish did you serve with the rosemary ice cream?
The rosemary one was served with a, courgette flour that we filled with.
That's
this,
a zucchini flour.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We would fill it with this filling of a type of cheese and
like
some other vegetables.
Like a ricotta-ish kind of thing.
Yeah, it's
soft
like
cheese.
It's fonteta, which is a type of almost like cottage cheese from northern Catalonia. It's it's a ricuit types of cheese that don't really exist here. But and then we'd fry it in tempura and we'd serve it alongside this little rosemary ice cream.
Okay, the rosemary ice cream. Did it have any, like, it wasn't, like, did it have an apple juice base or any kind of fruit or anything?
No, it was basically just, like, a cream base. So it was cream base, and we would
steep in a sugar syrup kind of thing?
Okay. Steep the rosemary in that cream.
Cream. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. We'd steep the rosemary in the cream and then strain that, add in the emulsifiers and all that stuff. We'd add in a little bit of sour cream, I remember, for the flavors. Mm-hmm. And then after adding all the emulsifiers, you have to reach to a certain temperature to make these stuff, make the emulsifiers activate. We would put it in the fridge, let it sit overnight with the rosemary, and it'd really get this really strong rosemary flavor.
You left the rosemary in it till you were ready to churn.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh, uh-huh. And then after that, you'd strain it and mm-hmm. then you'd churn it and then you'd take out the rosemary. Mm-hmm. We do this other ice cream, which is more on the savory side in the restaurant right now. It's an agua chile in a way. So agua chile is a Mexican, almost like cold soup, typically served with shrimp. And it's from the northern parts of Mexico.
And that's not cream-based, though, is
No,
it?
This one's not cream-based. And this one's really savory. This one's, it's...
So, an ice cream like that, is not, it's more like a sorbet, or did you make
No, this one's a sorbet.
Oh, okay.
So this one is a sorbet. The agua chile is a sorbet. And we use peach with it.
Oh, nice.
It's a really interesting ice cream. And it's savory. It's not sweet at all. It's a little bit salt on the saltier side, actually, if anything.
And what did you serve that with?
We serve that with tomatoes, so their tomatoes are in season everywhere. So,
yes.
In Spain, we serve them
so
with some
So you just
tomatoes.
Had sliced fresh tomatoes?
Basically, yeah. The dish itself, that we create this tomato water, which is basically we blend up tomatoes and then you strain it through
it off,
really fine cloth.
Uh-huh.
And you get this really clear liquid and you can create a gelatin out of that. So.
Oh, you made a gelatin. That's almost like an old-fashioned tomato aspic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
fun.
So we make this tomato jelly. We serve it with the tomato, this tomato itself.
It's gelée in French, which is, it doesn't mean, it's not jelly. It's cold, like a gelatin, right?
Yeah.
Tomato gelatin. Yeah.
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 And
then you put the chili ice cream on, or sorbet on top of the...
Yeah, just a little canela on top there. A little bit of tajin, chamoy.
A little what?
Tajin.
Tahini?
No. Tajin is the little Mexican spice mix that like...
Oh. T-A-J-I-N.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
That.
Yeah. Sorry, my Spanish is not like Jacob's. Right. Oh, so you just sprinkle...
A little bit
yeah,
on top.
Yeah,
I'm trying to think what else is in the dish. We have some types of herbs that we put on there.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're native to South America. We do fresh peach as well. There's a little bit of fresh peach on there.
Oh,
and that's about it.
Good idea.
Yeah.
Okay, question. All right. So this week is our plum harvest, right? By the grace of Helen Gunderson, we have a lot of really good, what did I say the variety was? Damson plums, which are really good eaters, right? So I have a glut of them because Helen just turned them all over to me, and I'm making different kinds of you have to cook them off because otherwise the fruit flies are going bonkers with them, right?
Yeah.
And they will go. So I've done a lot of rose geranium plum sauce. Now I'm starting with different things. I'm considering a plum ketchup, which is a savory thing. Mm-hmm. And maybe some years I've made an Asian plum sauce with garlic and tamari and sweetener. I gave Jacob a bunch of them. What are you going to do with them, Jacob?
I'll definitely take a good amount of them and just straight ferment them, 2% salt, and take the weight, 2% salt, and ferment those babies.
Are you going to cut them open and pit them and put salt on them?
Yeah, I'll probably cut them in half. They're pretty small, so
yeah.
Cut them in half and take out the seeds.
And how long will you ferment them? At room temperature?
Yeah, room temperature. The temperature around actually right now is pretty perfect for fermenting. It's around 28 Celsius.
Okay, for how long?
Mostly until however long I want, depending on how decomposed you want them. Or how much they start to pulp up.
And then do you push them through a strainer to pull?
Cut the fermenter. You mostly just stick them in the fridge once you're feeling happy.
Do you want the peels out or on?
I probably keep them on.
Okay.
Yeah, just keep them on.
And then what are you going to do with them once you've made them fermented?
I don't know.
we'll see how they taste.
That's for after.
All right, we will report back later.
It's plum decomposition.
Ice cream or whatever.
Yeah, you can make a really cool ice cream with that.
Anyway, when life gives you plums
that you have at it.
I might try and pull out a cocktail with them too.
This is a good idea.
You're listening to KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. Find out more at khoifm.org, and you can find out more about the radio station at that site, and find out more about the Donna Lana Kitchen. And Donna, tell them about our podcast.
Oh, right. So the same format that we have on the radio is then Lana cuts it up in the right pieces, and we have a podcast which is published on Thursdays after following the Tuesday live show, and you can hear it wherever you listen to podcasts all over the world. Just put in Donna Lana, one word, DonnaLonna, second word, kitchen, and there you have the podcast.
There we are. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. Plums. There's another thing that one can do with plums. Well, have at it.
We were talking about this. So Jacob's stepfather is Georgian, from the country of Georgia. And one thing characteristic of their cuisine, because we try to make Georgian things, because I'm infinitely curious about this. And Gio likes to, you know, it's fun. And he's always talking about these sour plums that are apparently, according to the Georgians, impossible to replicate here.
Yeah.
But I did look up in the New York Times, and there was an article for Georgian plum sauce. So
it usually is used as a base for different types of things.
Like lamb stews and stuff, right? Meat dishes.
I can't remember the names now.
Because it's Georgian.
Georgian, and they don't use vowels, so.
Yeah, right. But
I love Georgian food, though. But I think they also use it as just like a kind of general thing, almost like how you'd use a hot sauce. This like sourish plum. And there's the two versions for this one specific sauce, which I still can't remember the name. There's the sour one, which is used the green plums, and then there's the actual sweet one, which would be using the actual matured plums.
Okay, so we will be plumbing this week.
That's for sure.
I mean, I have buckets of them. Thank you, Helen. And so we can try a lot of different things. And if we get anything really spectacular, we will get back to you on that.
Exactly.
Yeah, we are in the middle of bounty right now.
Between the plums and the tomatoes, you know.
The plums that you gave me got turned into plum jam last night. And the thing
and how
is,
did you flavor that?
I didn't. I just made them plump. Oh, I put in lemon juice and sugar.
Okay, I was thinking of doing one with like allspice and cardamom or star anise.
That'd be a really good idea.
And going in that direction. Nope. Or actually, I'm going to get out that I've got a Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall Chinese plum sauce. I bet putting a little star
you
anise.
Made that one.
I have made it. It's really easy. It's just, you know, cook the plums down, add the garlic, some sugar, and the tamari, as I said. But I bet some star anise in that would be
that sounds fantastic.
Spectacular.
A winner.
Then we can make an ice cream out of it.
Or we can make an ice cream out of everything.
Make ice cream out of everything. Yes. Well, Jacob, you are in the middle of an amazing adventure. And tell us a bit more. Your formal education in Barcelona is ending, so kind of tell us what the timeline is, and then what's the plan?
Well, there's a thing that he's going to next it's called a stage, where you go to another restaurant and they try to
now,
bust you completely out.
That's when they actually turn you upside down.
Mm-hmm.
So now I have about 4 months left of this culinary school before I'm still part of the culinary school technically, but basically you're in the free world as a staging in a place.
Right, but they help place you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I basically have my two big projects and a couple little small exams, but it'll go by fast. And then in January or February is when I'd start my stage. So we start around now, the actual
hunting.
Process of hunting and figuring out where you want to go and why you want to go and if it's a good idea, if it's a bad idea, is it possible, is it not possible, whatever, all the little works of...
So tell us what your process is, what direction are you moving in with that?
So currently, at least for the number one picks, I would really love to go to either Noma, which would be in Copenhagen, a very famous restaurant in the culinary world.
It's been for a number of years the number one restaurant in the world. And the what's the name of the chef, Rene?
Rene Redzepi. Redzepi, yeah.
Is closing it, famously saying...
closing it for 6 years now every summer. Yeah, so we'll see if they're actually closing.
Famously saying that this type of high-end restaurant is an untenable business situation. Mm-hmm. That's a major critique coming from a guy at the top of the pile.
Yeah.
So, and it also has a reputation of going, you know, the people who go there for a stage often complain that they are given, like, you know, one job of picking the legs off of crickets for the whole 4 months or something like that. So
it's kind of part of it. I mean, at the end of the day, you're going there to learn, and it's kind of part of the job is like you're going to be there and you're going to have to do stupid tasks.
Very
and
tedious things.
Tedious
However,
tasks
he does have a whole separate building for fermentation.
Exactly. There's this whole thing of why Noma is special.
And he has the best fermentation book out on the market.
If you're going to go to Copenhagen to peel shrimps for 6 hours a day, like, why are you doing? Like, what's the point? And it's mostly because Noma's special. I mean, Noma, they teach you not even how to cook. They teach you a way to look at food.
How to think, how to smell, how to sleep, probably.
So those that are interested, there's a new series by Rene Redzepi. There's Omnivore, called Omnivore, that was just released. And he talks a little bit about different products from different places.
Where can you watch
world.
That one? Do you have any idea?
I don't know.
All right, we'll have to Google it. Okay, all right, I'm on it. We'll find out.
But it is an interesting... I've started watching it. It's a really interesting...
Okay, let's just say his style is a little different from Anthony Bourdain, okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's for sure.
This is the other end of the food world, practically.
And then another option would be Quintonil, which is in Mexico City. I kind of really love Mexican cuisine
food.
In general. It's been kind of a passion project I've started working on for since like a little bit now of like learning a little bit about it. And I love the spice. I love the acid. I love how explosive it is. How you can create so many different flavors inside of a little tiny little taco, a little tortilla. And there are millions of other variations of it, different things of pozoles and aguachiles and all this different stuff that's so regional and so... There's a lot of things that are
at
unique.
At your culinary school, how are they viewing your interest in Mexican food?
I mean, they kind of get... Like, every year they get new students who come from all over and they're kind of used to, I guess, the tons of different variation and where
people
go.
Okay, but it's a completely different cuisine than what they're teaching you.
Yeah, but I said they don't really mind. I mean, to be fair, we kind of jump around a lot in the restaurant itself of, like, techniques. it's based on the restaurant used to be super, super French, and these really traditional styles, but it's definitely branched out a lot. And for instance,
well, that's good because we can't do that anymore.
We've been doing things like we've done moles and all these different types of things in the restaurant itself.
Well, and obviously some of the techniques are the same. I mean, moles are all about learning to sauce and extract and combine, you know, I mean, it's different ingredients, but the techniques are overlapping in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And it isn't like, definitely, at least for Mexico, they have a lot of kind of interesting techniques in particular that are like really unique to what Mexico, to Mexico, especially just looking at what a mole is, which basically means sauce, but the actual famous mole of the black mole, which we do from Oaxaca.
Okay, moles. Just so everybody knows, not all moles include chocolate, okay?
Yeah.
Some good ones do, but...
There's tons of different types. There's green ones, there's yellow ones, there's red ones. They're usually defined by the colors.
I bet you could
colors.
Put some plums in a mole.
You could for sure make a mole out of plums. I actually need to... I want to make a mole, so maybe I'll put some plums in there.
Okay, okay.
It'll be fun.
Yeah, that's a good acid for right now.
Yeah.
Better than the limes and lemons you can get in the market right now, so... Yeah.
They're going to be sad.
So who decides, do you just show up at these restaurants with your portfolio and you say, can I join? Or it's a long process?
No, it's negotiated.
No. So because of the fact that for the stage, you're still under the name of Hoffman. So you're still representing Hoffman. So they don't allow you to go just anywhere and screw you up. And also it's kind of hard just go in there blind. Mm-hmm. So how it works is, for instance, right before I came on vacation, they asked us, can you send me an email to the creative director and to academic director and say, like, these are the places I want to go, kind of ranked. After that comes the whole process of, like, they say, yeah, we think this is a good idea for you. You can do whatever, like, we can look. I don't know this restaurant. I'll have to look. Or I know this restaurant. I can definitely send you there. For instance, Quinto Nino was one of these places where they're like, they don't really know the restaurant. So they definitely were like, I kind of have to scout it out and I can let you know after that. And then there's the whole issues of visas and everything. There's also the part where they can't send anybody just anywhere. They can't, those people who are struggle a little bit more in class and don't give it the energy that maybe.
Well, yeah, because the reputation of the school stands on who they send out. Yeah.
They can't really be sending these people to places like Noma or the Sergan Roca, all these like, or Disfrutar, these like huge big name restaurants, just to be destroyed in those restaurants.
Well, it'll be wonderful to find out where you end up, and there will be more stories.
Right, and that's only the stage. After that, the world is your oyster.
Oyster.
Yeah.
After that, usually the general route people go down is they kind of get a connection at these stages, and someone finds a little job, like a job, a place they want, they could go to, they recommend. For instance, I know one of my upperclassmen who's right now is just finishing up at Noma. After completing a stage around 5 months there, he spent there.
Mm-hmm.
He found some contact of this Catalan chef that was creating this Catalan restaurant in Japan. And he's always wanted to live in Japan and he knows Catalan food. So he called him up. He was like, hey, I would love to live in Japan. I know Catalan food. I speak Catalan. I'm from Barcelona, whatever, whatever. Went to Hoffman, finishing up at Noma, and I know in September he already has a job lined up in Tokyo, working in this restaurant.
Fantastic. Thank you for being with us today, Jacob. We had a whirlwind tour of
culinary school, high-end,
so that's what it's like.
Yeah, right.
Well, keep
in
touch.
For having me.
This is good. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Good. Well, I have a few upcomings here. The KHOI radio station here is going to have a book sale Friday, September 6th, Saturday, September 7th, and Sunday, September 8th. Mark your calendars, clean out your bookshelves, come and find more. And also the Central Iowa Barn Dance starts its fall season again this Saturday, August 24th. Find out more information on Facebook, Central Iowa Barn Dance Association. Yes, sirree. Very good. And plums. Oh, there's still plums. We'll be dealing
plums
with that.
Plums and tomatoes.
And tomatoes.
And peppers.
And tomatoes.
Oh, everything.
You've been listening to the Donnell on a Kitchen. We come to you live at noon on Tuesdays and repeat at 7 p.m. or anytime at the station website or on our podcast. Support community radio.
My name is Lana Nachtigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
Excellent Engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.